Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Eddie Glaude Jr. about his forthcoming book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. He will be appearing at this weekend's New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University. It's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Eddie Glaude to The Reading Life. Eddie Glaude is the James S. McDonald Distinguished University Professor and Chair of the Center for African American Studies at Princeton University. He's the former president of the American Academy of Religion, a commentator for MSNBC, and the author of a number of books, including Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. Today, we'll be previewing his new book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own, to be published in April. Professor Glaude, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, because this is The Reading Life and because we're talking about James Baldwin, I thought I'd like to start with my favorite quote from that writer, which I hold dear to my heart. You think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read.
Yeah.
And you've been reading Baldwin for 30 years, right?
Something like that, yes.
Now, what does it mean to you to have a writer like this who helps you read the world as you go through life?
Well, you know, I mean, my journey with James Baldwin has been a complicated one. You know, I really didn't start reading him seriously until graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, it was kind of fraught and vexed because I knew that Baldwin was going to ask something of me that I wasn't quite ready for. So when I first got to graduate school, I say this in the book, that I only wanted to read, I was reading primarily Ralph Ellison because I thought his mask fit perfectly, you know.
Right.
That there was something about his elegance and sophistication that held people off, it, you know, kept people at a distance. But Jimmy, when you read him, there was always this kind of unsettling quality that he was shifting the ground beneath your feet, trying to force you to look at, in some ways, the ugliness that has shaped you, the messiness of your life, your mm-hmm. interior life, and how it evidences itself in the world that you inhabit. So, you know, when I finally turned to him, you know, it was this kind of, okay, let me just step into this storm and, you know, the examined life.
Yes. I'm ready now.
I think it's time. And so it's been this amazing kind of journey of thinking about the personal, thinking about autobiography and the political and the ethical and the democratic all at once. And so it's been an amazing journey.
Well, you know, I keep all of his books together in one spot. And every now and then I'll just pull one out and kind of open it at random. And he's sort of like the I Ching. You know what I mean?
Yes, indeed.
There's something kind of, you find something useful on every page, however random. And do you think, you said, I think you referred to yourself as, I was an Ellison man. And do you think that's kind of a natural selection, you know, one or the other?
I think so. Maybe not. I don't know. You know, I think what Ellison offered me was a kind of obvious sophistication. You could see his bibliography on the page. You knew who he was reading. You know, oh, this is this reference to the symbolic. I could see he's engaged with Kenneth Burke here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I could see him reading, you know, I loved Shadow and Act and Going to the Territory, right? His nonfiction essays.
Right.
And they're just so insightful. You know, change the joke, slip the yoke. We need to be reading that every day. But there was something distant about, you know, you couldn't find Ellison in those essays, right? I mean, mm-hmm. he was there, but it was something different. Baldwin is all over the page. He's laying bare his soul for you. And of course, there are moments in which, you know, there's the constructed Baldwin there, but it's very different. So for me, as a person who didn't want to confront the experiences that shaped me, Ellison was such an easy choice because he was talking about democracy, talking about the ethical dimensions of democracy, talking about black life and race in ways that I was interested in, but it's tidy. Plus, there's this added thing, right? Whenever I read Ellison with my white colleagues, I didn't have to worry about them getting uncomfortable.
Ah, interesting.
But when I read Baldwin with them, I always had to deal with and navigate their discomfort.
Well, and you say you didn't want to deal with the experiences that shaped you. And we should say that some of those experiences took place in Moss Point, Mississippi.
Yeah, right down.
So you're a neighbor.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah.
Oh. Now, so much of what we find in Baldwin's writing, properly examined, as you say, is nuance and complexity, that there aren't easy slogans there. There are springboards to thought and action. So talk about that experience of taking those springboards and jumping.
Yeah, and this is really important for me, you know, reading like Notes of a Native Son and Many Thousands Gone, for example, in that text, and grappling with what he's talking about with regards to categorizations. What does it mean for us to think of ourselves as white and black and straight and gay and you know, these things, right? Mm-hmm. And he's not trying to appeal to some sentimental, syrupy notion of universality, right? He's trying to think about how these categories work to protect us from the mysteries of life, to block us off from the human being right in front of us, to provide a kind of comfort in the familiar, mm-hmm. as it were. And then to read that critique of categorization all the way through and see it show up in 1972 in No Name in the Street, or to see it evidenced in speeches in 1987, the last year of his life. So for me, Baldwin will leave certain formulations aside, but he's constantly folding back on them, coming back to them, and revisiting them in light of his experiences. Right, in light of the life lived. And in this sense, I tend to read Baldwin as a kind of inheritor of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Mm-hmm. Like he's taking Emerson across the tracks. And what does perfectionism, Emersonian perfectionism, look like across the tracks? Right, where brokenness is the starting point. Where a country, you know, organized in such a way that you have to work hard not to despise yourself. So what does it mean to reach for one's higher angels under those conditions? And so Baldwin is constantly doing that as he engages in this radical effort to be an artist, you know. So I'm always taken by the nuance of his formulations, that he refuses to settle for the simplistic. Mm-hmm. And in his corpus, safety is always dangerous.
Right.
So when we try to retreat to safety and comfort, when we try to retreat to certainty in safety and comfort, we set ourselves up to become more monstrous.
If you're just joining us, I've been speaking with Professor Eddie Glaude Jr., author of Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. We'll be right back. Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. You're talking about big ideas of America in Baldwin's time and now. And it seems like he's having a moment. You know, sometimes it seems like he's stepping back up to the stage now that we need him. But he's never really left, do you think?
No, he's always been here. You know, I mean, in some ways, when we deal with Jimmy, we have to deal with this early, late Jimmy. I mean, we don't really deal with that in the Academy anymore. That's been put aside. But in common kind of popular thinking about Baldwin, there's this kind of hard distinction between the early Baldwin where he was at the top of his game and then the later Baldwin where he has succumbed to bitterness and the propaganda of black power and the like. And so what we are witnessing now is a kind of resurgence or renaissance around him where that kind of divide, which actually presumes a set of judgments about his politics and his aesthetics, aren't really guiding people in how they read him. So, you know, people are looking at If Beale Street Could Talk, right? Mm-hmm. Or I'm Not Your Negro, Raoul Peck's beautiful documentary. Yeah. And then you have Black Lives Matter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where these students are trying to queer black politics and queer black leadership, and they're drawing on resources to help them imagine a different way of engaging not only the state, but engaging black America as well. And so Baldwin becomes this resource because he's always engaged in this intense and intimate reflection on who we take ourselves to be as Americans, right? We are the object of his genius, his brilliance, you know?
Yes. Oh.
And so that's why I think he's constantly coming back. But I think the resurgence, the popular resurgence, has something to do with you know, the success of the documentary and the like, and the movement.
So much, though, of what Baldwin is talking about, and I find this very consoling sometimes in these troubled times we live in, is that he is talking about radical love. He is, at heart, a lover in so many ways. And that is perhaps one of the most difficult things to accomplish in such times. And I wonder if you'd read a section from your book about how we have to find that kind of resource within ourselves.
Okay. That community doesn't have to take any particular shape or form. It simply has to be genuine. It can be made up of family or people who hold similar commitments, or those who make us laugh with full belly laughs, and those without whom we could not imagine living. Here, genuine mutuality serves as the basis for a broader, more collective expression of mutuality necessary for a vibrant democracy. Ralph Ellison was right. Quote, the way home we seek is that condition of one being at home in the world, which is called love, and we term democracy, end quote. Baldwin sought refuge among those who weren't concerned about his fame or his political standing, but who offered him a place of nurturance to heal his wounds and an intellectual space to think creatively. They gave him space to enjoy his pleasures of cooking, of drink and company, a space to express his rage and vulnerability. They loved him. Love takes off the mask, and when experienced deeply, it fortifies the soul and offers a cure for what ails our living together. In our time, with so much hatred and venom in our politics and culture, we must actively cultivate communities of love that allow us to imagine different ways of being together. That means pulling people we love closer, opening ourselves to the unexpected pleasure of meeting and knowing someone new, and retreating into the comfort of their company as a material counterweight to the ugliness of our politics. We must try as best as we can to find the space, however fleeting, that makes possible the utter joy expressed in Jimmy's face on the balcony looking out on Tuscany Square. We also have to engage in a critical inventory of who we take ourselves to be, and to make a decision to choose life. I do not mean this only in some collective sense. Baldwin referred to the individual and the torment of one's private life. He insisted again that the unexamined life was not worth living. To live and move about the world without questioning how the world has shaped and is shaping you is, in a way, to betray the gift of life itself, Baldwin argued. In our aftertime, in the full light of the country's latest betrayal, we have to find the courage to confront honestly the lies that rest in us, if we are to confront and change the lies that confound the nation. Baldwin remained committed to the idea that the disaster of our private lives shaped our public witness. We have to work on ourselves if we are to live up to the kind of world we want to create. The props and crutches that have supported our individual identities in this country have been knocked from under our arms and feet. We have to make of ourselves the new creation without them. In the face of his elegant despair, Baldwin discovered in himself that he could act. But this required looking back on his life, understanding as best as he could the choices he had made that brought him to that point of desperation and possibility. We have to do the same in our individual lives if we are to call the nation to be otherwise. It is the only way we can become the kinds of people that a genuine democracy requires.
Welcome back. I've been speaking with Eddie Glaude Jr., author of Begin Again, James Baldwin's America, and its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. How did your students react to this? Because you've been teaching Baldwin for a long time, and you thank them in your acknowledgments for their participation in your seminars.
I usually teach the Baldwin seminar, and it's just all of his nonfiction from the beginning to the end. And I taught that seminar during the election cycle that produced Donald Trump.
Whoa.
And I was just blown away by my students. And then the next semester, the next time I taught it, was little less than a year after he got in office. And so the students were inhabiting his writing, his prophecies, his reckoning in real time. And I just watched them kind of bring it to bear on the moment. And it actually changed the nature of the book. So initially I was just going to write, write with Baldwin, just write about him, right? And then I just watched them as they were just constantly thinking about their current situation, their moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned so much. They were trying to find a language to describe the horror that they were experiencing, right? And because the class is self-selecting, obviously. Most of them had a particular political orientation. And Jimmy just kept giving them words to describe what they were feeling. And then they saw his trajectory. They saw his despair. What did it mean when they were reading the last interview and they see him describing himself as a despairing witness?
Mm.
You know, I feel like a broken motor saying the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. Right? I was there. I saw what they did. I saw, you know, to hear him in those moments, right, when cancer is ravaging his throat, and to figure out how in the hell could he still have faith in us after what he's witnessed. And just, you know, so my students, they were amazing. And the papers were just stunning.
Ah, and you were paying it forward. You were,
yes.
You know, you were starting up several years of wrestling with Baldwin for them, too, I'm sure.
I pray that that's true.
Oh, I'm sure it is. You've done that for me just with this book. I mean, so what did you learn about yourself? How did this move you on the path of your writing life, which has been so varied, you know, but so productive?
I've been grappling since day one with my own pain. You know, Exodus is this book about how this religious story was used by African Americans in the early 19th century to imagine nationhood, peoplehood, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I was trying to make sense of Black nationalism. Why? Because I had become this Black nationalist when I was at Morehouse. Why? Because I found an ideology that could give voice to my father's rage. And so always this excavation of, within the confines of academic writing, of those deeply visceral, personal things, elements that moved me about. What Baldwin did for me, this book did for me. It's such a hard question to answer because, mm-hmm. you know, I'm grayer, I'm a little balder, but he freed the hell out of me to put my anger on the page, to take risks, to find the sentence that could capture all of my passion and thinking. I use this as an example. You know, you read a sentence by Edwige Dandecott, and it's not overwrought. It's not ornate. Mm-hmm. It can't be, because she's trying to carry forward a kind of pain that is unimaginable sometimes, right? So you read that sentence, and it's so simple. It's so pure, right? And you got to go, oh, my goodness. But it has to be that way, because she's trying to it's carrying forward something. So I'm more attentive to what's on the page, because I'm more attentive to what's in me. And I know what I can't do now. Mm-hmm. I know where my cowardice evidences itself. I know the limits of my courage. Well, not really. Not really.
Well.
But you know what I mean? You know, he throws you back on yourself. And so it's been this amazing journey.
And you've stepped forward in his footsteps as a public intellectual. You speak out in these times, and you represent.
You know, I try to. It's so hard on a certain level to try to figure out how to be nuanced and reach for complexity within the confines of a soundbite, mm-hmm. where surface is the order of the day and seriousness is taking a beating. So what I've been trying to do is figure out how to bring my bibliography, the reading, into the public domain. Because, you know, the beautiful thing about Baldwin is, oh my God, he's reading everybody.
Right. I love that.
You can see it. It's not like he's citing people, right? But you can see it on the page, right? Mm-hmm. You can say, oh my God, it takes a stern discipline to just step in the room with him. And so just trying to speak truth, trying to bear witness, trying to be vulnerable, trying to be true, trying to give sound to the genuine in a moment where everything seems to be so surfaced, you know?
Well, he's given you many gifts, but you've certainly paid them forward.
Thank you so much. That means making me smile. You made my day.
We've been talking with Professor Eddie Glaude Jr. about his inspiring and provocative new book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. Professor Glaude, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate you.
We mourn the loss of William Griffin, such an important figure in New Orleans literary life for so long. He died in February at his home in Alexandria. For 20 years, he was a book editor, first for Harker Brace Jovanovich, then for Macmillan. He specialized in religious books, and one of his special charges was the posthumous publication of the work of C.S. Lewis, including The Joyful Christian. Griffin moved to New Orleans with his family in 1980 and kept up his literary work here. He was the longtime religious books editor for Publishers Weekly and wrote several novels. Many will remember with affection The Fleetwood Correspondence, his very funny response to the Screwtape letters of C.S. Lewis. In 1986, he published Clive Staples Lewis, A Dramatic Life. He was a generous advocate and friend to many New Orleans writers who visited the Griffin's book-lined home on Britannia Street. He is survived by his wife, Emily Dietrich Griffin, herself a beloved author of 18 books, their three children, Lucy, Sarah, and Henry, and their families, which include 5 grandchildren. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Emily Nemen signs her first novel, The Cactus League, and appears in conversation with Josh Wheeler, Monday, March 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Esoterotica presents Esoterotica Into the Dark, erotic readings by local writers, Wednesday, March 18th at 8 at the Always Lounge, 2240 St. Claude Avenue. Katie Yellow discusses and signs New Orleans mural street art graffiti, Volume 1, Thursday, March 19th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Saturday Writers Clinic for March features authors Bill Lofilm, who will discuss how to create and sustain suspense and tension, and James Nolan, who will focus on point of view. This event takes place Saturday, March 21st, with Bill Lofilm speaking at 9:30, followed by James Nolan at 11 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Inspired by Tom Dent's essay Nostalgia, St. Joseph's Day Celebrations, or The Origins of Super Sunday, that's in this year's One Book Selection, New Orleans Griot, the Tom Dent Reader. One Book, One New Orleans invites you to a discussion and cultural presentation by the Mardi Gras Indian Collective, Saturday, March 21st at noon at the Donald Harrison Senior Museum, 1930 Independence Street. Learn the history and rituals behind the St. Joseph's Day celebrations from those who fanned the flames of tradition. Free. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library conduct its semi-annual Big Book Sale from Thursday, April 2nd to Sunday, April 5th at the Pontchartrain Center, 4545 Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are 10 to 8 p.m. Thursday through Saturday, April 2nd to 4th, and 12 noon to 5 p.m. Sunday, April 5th. Congratulations to Jessica Harris, who has been named the recipient of the 2020 James Beard Lifetime Achievement Award. Harris is an author, editor, and translator of 18 books. Her 12 works on food document the food ways of the African diaspora, a topic on which she is considered the ranking expert. Following in the footsteps of icon Leah Chase, she is the second African-American woman to receive this award. Jessica Harris will be honored at this year's 30th anniversary of the James Beard Awards Monday, May 4th at the Lyric Opera of Chicago. As a result of the coronavirus pandemic, the New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University has been canceled. The Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival and the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival have been canceled as well. Check the Reading Life webpage at wwno.org for updates on other upcoming literary festivals set for the future as they make their decisions going forward. For the Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org.